Welcome to the Beyond Atheism podcast with me, Nathan Alexander, and my co-host, Todd Tavares. Moving beyond questions of God's existence, this podcast asks, what's next in a world without God? If you're enjoying the show so far, make sure to like and subscribe, rate and review, and consider supporting us on Patreon.
The atheist movement is seen as a relatively recent phenomenon, largely attributed to the new atheists of the early 2000s. But while the vigor of the new atheists has faded, the small a atheism of the irreligious or religiously indifferent population has continued to grow. Today we're joined by Dr. Will Gervais, senior lecturer in psychology at Brunel University in London, to discuss the factors that increase the likelihood of being irreligious, how widespread non-belief actually is, and how the godless are perceived by believers. Professor Gervais, welcome to Beyond Atheism.
Thank you for having me. It's great to join you.
Yeah, we're super excited to have you here.
Yeah, thanks so much, Will, for taking the time to talk with us. Just to begin, can you tell us how you got into studying the psychology of religion and atheism?
Oh, man, my journey to studying atheism was sort of a roundabout one, actually. In my undergrad days, I actually started out as an environmental sciences major and then kind of kicked the tires on, I was thinking pre-med for a while. Didn't really like that, but I had done a bunch of reading. I was really interested in evolutionary biology. Actually, I read like The Selfish Gene. I read a bunch of Stephen Jay Gould and was just fascinated by the ideas. But yeah, I got into the evolutionary biology side, and then eventually I ended up reading some sort of pop evolutionary psychology books right around the same time where I actually took a couple of my first psychology classes. And I thought, all right, I could do psychology, but keep the evolutionary focus. Meanwhile, on a totally separate trajectory, I had been just kind of casually curious about religion. So I had taken some philosophy classes and religious studies classes, but I hadn't thought of that as an academic pursuit at all. It was just kind of a casual interest on the side. And then really around the time when I was thinking about applying to graduate school, as much as anything else, because I didn't know what else to do, I enjoyed school. So I thought, hey, I should keep doing this. And so I was looking around for places where I could kind of apply evolution to psychology and was applying to a few places. And then I saw that at the University of British Columbia, which is where I ended up doing my graduate school, there was a guy there by the name of Ara Noren Zion, who was one of a few people at the time who had started kind of saying, well, why is it that we as a species have religion? So he had just started shifting from cultural psychology to starting to look at why we have religion. So what's the evolutionary psychology of religion? And then it kind of clicked for me that, oh, you know, this thing that I had always thought of as a side interest, it turns out that people actually study this for a living, and I could be one of those people. So it kind of clicked, and then it was off to graduate school.
Can you tell us a little bit more about evolutionary psychology? Evolutionary biology, I think, is something, it's more commonly understood. It's easy to wrap your head around. But what is evolutionary psychology, and why is it useful for examining disbelief or religious beliefs?
Yeah, I think evolutionary psychology is an interesting one because the term itself can apply to a lot of different things. So I think of it most broadly as just the idea that we can take the huge kind of theoretical toolkit of evolutionary biology and mine that to come up with hypotheses to test as a psychology researcher. So there's a bunch of kind of distinct sub-schools of thought within evolutionary psychology, but I kind of adopt it broadly. It's just that I'm a psychologist, and I think that evolutionary biology is a good place to start if I want to kind of apply theories and generate hypotheses. So I don't necessarily subscribe to any specific school within the evolutionary psychology one. It's just that I'm a psychologist and I think evolution's a nifty place to come up with hypotheses. So that's how I use it. There's definitely kind of specific approaches within EvPsych. Like there's the Santa Barbara School of EvPsych has their way of doing things. The Arizona State School has their way of doing things. A lot of people don't actually belong to any of these camps. They're just people who kind of like me say, hey, I do psychology and I read about evolution, and let's put those two things together.
And it sounds experimental. Is that something that like you work on scientifically, devising experiments?
For sure. So for the most part, people who are doing evolutionary psychology, they're just like any other kind of run-of-the-mill academic psychologist, where we do survey research, we design in-lab experiments. A lot of people actually methodologically look a lot like a social psychologist. So my PhD, you know, sometimes I'll call myself an evolutionary psychologist or a cultural psychologist, but the wording on my actual PhD is social psychology. UBC had a social psych program with some evolutionary minded people. So the methodological toolkit in ev psych is going to be just the same as any other domain of psychology. But kind of where the rubber meets the road is that we're using evolutionary theory to pick which hypotheses we want to test with, you know, run of the mill psychology methodologies.
So I guess then what, if you've been looking at where atheists come from or irreligious people, have you run studies on that? And what were the findings?
Yeah, so over really going back to my master's thesis and PhD work, I was really interested in kind of trying to figure out the evolution of religion. So how our species has religion. And then pretty early on, I realized that there was a lot of work and kind of theory papers arguing of here's why we have religion, or here's, you know, here's another reason we might have religion. And there wasn't as much work on the absence of religion. So where do atheists come from? And for me, that seems like a really important test case for any theory of religion. If it doesn't say useful things about atheists, then it's at best a very impartial theory. So I really started diving into atheists. What are people's perceptions of atheists? Where might atheism come from? And so, we've done a fair amount of work trying to isolate kind of specific psychological or cultural factors that might nudge people towards atheism. And so some of the ones we've found, I mean, the overall spoiler, the biggest factor across a lot of work now is just kind of, it comes down to a lot of what you're culturally learning as you grow up. So a lot of it comes down to upbringing. And specifically, it seems like if you're growing up in an environment where you see kind of your cultural models, people you're trying to learn from, if they are showing kind of credible behavioral cues that they believe in specific gods, it's a lot more likely that you'll come to believe in those gods. Imagine if you grow up and you see your parents are tithing and they regularly attend church, they're taking time out of their busy week to go to church. Or if you're witnessing people having dietary restrictions, if they're avoiding some foods because of their religious beliefs, it's these behavioral cues that kind of show other people, hey, these people are serious about their beliefs, and I should maybe believe the same stuff. But what happens is some people grow up just not getting those consistent behavioral cues to believe in any given God. Maybe they grow up somewhere more secular and just nobody's all that religious. Or it could be that they're growing up in an area that's kind of really mixed in terms of religion. So you're seeing a lot of people showing cues directed at different gods. And so if you're getting that missed signal, maybe these people will grow up not to believe in any gods. Yeah. So it seems like these cultural cues are the big player.
But and also if they're not credible, can you delve into that a bit more? What does it mean by like a symbol being credible in that sense? It doesn't mean it's expensive or that it's honest. When we think about something that's a credible commitment, how does that differ from something that's merely symbolic?
Yeah, there's a great body of theory and experimental work on this now coming out of the subfield of cultural evolution, which is a field just looking at how is it that culture changes over time? How do we learn from each other? And there's sort of a trick in this work, which is, you know, we want to learn from either, you know, most people in our environment or the most successful people. And so we try to figure out who we're going to imitate and whose kind of beliefs we want to model ours after. We can be taken advantage of, essentially. Like, let's say I imagine, or if I'm trying to learn from the successful people and I pick somebody and I think, all right, I'm going to copy whatever this guy does. And I go up to that guy and say, you know, teach me. Well, that person, they can absolutely exploit my gullibility because I'm paying deference to them for access to, you know, I'm trying to learn from them. I might try to curry favor with them and they could sell me total nonsense. So there's plenty of snake oil salesmen out there. But if I can try to only learn stuff from them that I feel like I can be confident that they actually believe it, so that's really important, is to find kind of cues to their underlying sincerity. And one key is to look for, this comes out of some theoretical work by Joe Henrich, who's now at Harvard. And he said, if we can look for behaviors that would be costly if this person didn't actually believe what they're saying. So that sounds kind of muddled, but we can give a tangible example. So let's say I'm trying to learn from Joe. He's a fancy pants professor at Harvard. I want to learn how to be successful like him. And maybe I'm going to copy whatever he does, but maybe he says, all right, here's some food. Here's some mushrooms. These mushrooms are delicious and nutritious. Now, should I eat the mushroom? This comes down to me trying to figure out, does he actually believe that these mushrooms are delicious and nutritious? So maybe they actually are, and he's given me a free tip about what I should eat, but maybe he's trying to poison me. So maybe he knows these are toxic mushrooms. And you know, I've just been pestering him with too many questions. Now he's trying to poison me. Well, it turns out if he takes a bite of one of these mushrooms, okay, I can infer that he actually believes they're delicious and nutritious. So here I see him eating it. And if he didn't believe that they were delicious and nutritious, that would be hugely costly for him. But if they actually are delicious and nutritious, there's no cost to him for eating them. So it's just that kind of, it would be costly if there was a mismatch between what he's saying and what he actually believes.
Yeah. That clears things up. I really see how this is psychology, right? Because it's about what we think and how we estimate and understand things and how it relates to religion, especially things like Ramadan, fasting during Ramadan, especially, right? That would be very, very costly. Whereas in our society, the social cost of wearing a crucifix or wearing a cross, that's not expensive. You can wear a cross and not believe. It's not necessarily credible because the cost is so low and there's not really anything lost by wearing it, right? Is that correct?
Yeah, exactly. And there's some really cool work looking at how some religions have done a better job at kind of ratcheting up these credible displays. And it seems like that might promote kind of cooperation within groups. It can predict the longevity of the group. And yeah, so it seems like a lot of successful religions have hit on a bunch of good cultural tricks for, you know, you build in some credibility enhancing displays. This is good for kind of getting people to believe it. It might also help kind of cement cooperation within the group. So you get these kind of clusters of co-evolved norms and beliefs that work well with each other. Most of the big successful world religions have these.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like there's sort of two kind of issues. Like, on the one hand, there's the question of like what makes particular societies more or less religious. And then there's the question of like what makes individuals within different societies more or less religious. And I guess we can probably talk about both, but I wanted to ask, are there sort of different psychological profiles of like individuals who become, say they're, I mean, living in the US or Canada or whatever, like, are they sort of different psychologically than other people? I mean, like who become atheists? I mean,
yeah, a lot of the work coming out of our lab and other labs, we've tried to pin down kind of, you know, aside from the obvious cultural cues one, I think that's, you know, kind of the most obvious one. Hey, if you grow up around people who are strongly religious and act on it, you're more likely to be religious. If you grow up around people who aren't really selling it, then you won't be religious. But we have looked for kind of some more subtle psychological and cognitive differences that might be able to explain a bit of the variability in beliefs. And a couple of them, it turns out, none of these are particularly large associations, but it turns out there are kind of some distinct cognitive predictors. So one of them is that people, thinking back to work by Danny Kahneman, had a book, Thinking Fast and Slow, recently, talking about how people can either process information kind of by going with the gut and using quick and dirty intuitions, or people can rely on more effortful, analytic, rational processing. And it turns out there's individual differences in how much people like to go with the gut versus kind of thinking more effortfully. It turns out that at least in samples in the US, that's correlated with religious belief versus atheism. So people who rely on intuitions more tend to be a little bit more religious. People who rely on the effortful analytic thinking tend to be a bit less religious. And it's not a huge correlation there, but it does seem to reliably show up, at least in U.S. samples. But we're talking about, you know, the correlations tend to be relatively modest. So that might explain, you know, a bit of the individual differences we see in religiosity, but it's not like a hugely significant factor.
So are you saying that atheists, because Nathan and I are atheists, and we've assumed that we possess something special. Is that just not true? Atheists aren't special. We're products of the environment, of social forces, of having these credible commitments presented to us or not presented to us.
Yeah, it's funny. This is the one where I feel like there's the biggest gap between sort of the narratives I get when I talk to atheists and then what the research is saying. So sometimes I'll give, you know, chats to atheist groups, and sometimes I'll ask them, well, why are you people atheists? And kind of the most typical story is people say, well, I grew up in this strongly religious family and, you know, we went to church every Sunday. But then, you know, I went to college and I took some philosophy classes and then I read some Darwin and I just thought about religion and it didn't make any sense. And so I'm an atheist because I'm so clever and I figured it out. And that's the narrative, and it's a super common narrative. But then when we actually look at the data on, you know, what's the correlation between this effortful analytic thinking and atheism, it's a pretty small correlation. So it's not nothing, but it's not the main causal factor either. And what I think is really interesting is, I guess a couple of years ago, we published a piece where we were able to, as a big nationally representative sample in the U.S., and we had measures of these credibility enhancing displays of religion and a measure of this kind of effortful analytic thinking. And we were able to see how those interact with each other. So we could specifically kind of test the narrative where people are saying, oh, I grew up strongly religious and then just thought my way to atheism. And we could do some specific analyses where we'd say, all right, let's look at the people who grew up in an environment where they were just maxed out on credibility enhancing displays of religion. So people who grew up in a strongly religious context, what's the correlation among those people between analytic thinking and atheism? And it turns out that among those people, the correlation goes to exactly zero. So among the people most strongly exposed to religion growing up, this effortful analytic thinking is totally uncorrelated with how religious they are. Which, that one surprised me, but I suppose it makes sense because you'll have a ton of people who grew up in a strongly religious environment and they're, you know, really analytic, rational thinkers. And it seems like, well, they might become atheists or they might stay in religion. And these are our theologians and religious philosophers. So a lot of people are thinking really effortfully and rationally about religion specifically.
So one of the problems we run into all the time is the difference between sort of like big A atheists and small A atheists, where the big A atheists are people who are self-identified as atheists. Not only, you know, that's very strong. We know there's no God. We live in a material world, all that stuff. And sort of small A atheists who are either indifferent, they don't have religious affiliation, they may be spiritual. It's a whole different set. Is this, when you're talking about atheists here, are you talking about people who are the big A strong atheist, or is this the sort of the group of nuns, people with no religion?
I guess in my research, I tend to, I guess we kind of end up halfway between those two. So I think, talking about sort of the nuns versus people who identify with some religion, the nun group ends up being a lot of people who they're probably still more or less religious. They still believe in a God, but they've just ended up disaffiliating with specific religious traditions. But then also in the nuns, you'll get a lot of people who don't believe in God, So they're by definition an atheist, but they don't want to apply that tag either. So in a lot of our research, instead of kind of trying to figure out what label people want to use for themselves, do they call themselves an atheist? Do they call themselves an agnostic? Instead, we'll just ask people specifically about, you know, do you believe in God? So the people who don't believe in God are by definition atheists, even though in our samples, at least in the US, only like 10% of the people who say they don't believe in God also say they're an atheist. So our work, we end up trying to predict who does or does not believe in God. And then we'll just call the people who say no atheists, because that's simpler than saying people who don't believe in God every time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. And you've written a little bit about this idea that potentially we're undercounting the number of atheists in the US. And you had a pretty clever way, I thought, to try and like get at the actual number. And maybe you can tell us about how you did that.
Yeah, so this is some work that I did with Maxime Nafe, who's one of my former students who's now doing kind of public policy polling. And we were interested in looking at just kind of some basic questions about atheists, like how many of them are there? And so sociologist Phil Zuckerman, back in, I believe it was 07, he wrote a chapter just trying to count how many atheists there are in the world. And so he was cobbling together some census data and then like large scale Pew and Gallup surveys. Sometimes they'll ask people about religion, but these different data sources don't always ask the question in the same way. So some of them, you know, will give people the list of religious identities. Are you Catholic? Are you Protestant? Are you Muslim? Are you Sikh? Are you atheist? Are you agnostic? And then you count how many people check the atheist box. And like in the US, by that approach, it's like 2 to 3% of people are atheists. But you look at other polls that just ask people, do you believe in God? Yes or no. And it turns out the number of people who answer that question in the negative is a lot higher than the number of people who say they're atheists. So when we did this work in 2017, 2018, at the time, it was like 12% of Americans said they don't believe in God. That number has been steadily climbing in polls since then. But Maxine and I, we were thinking, well, what if even this is substantially undercounting the prevalence of atheists, just because atheism is so kind of stigmatized and socially loaded? So we have a whole bunch of other work over the years looking at kind of people's really stark negative perceptions of atheists. And then a lot of other researchers have done work that atheists are well aware of these negative perceptions of them, which is kind of becomes a methodological hurdle for figuring out how many atheists there are. Because if you're relying on self-reports and it's a socially loaded category, people don't want to just tell somebody, yeah, I'm an atheist. You know, that group that everybody hates, that's me. It's not going to work. So we thought there might be a lot of sort of closeted atheists out there who aren't even showing up in surveys. Because a lot of the surveys, they're conducted via telephone. So, you know, you're sitting at home cooking dinner and the phone rings and you answer it and it's a stranger and they want to ask you some questions. And then all of a sudden they ask you if you believe in God. And like, okay, you could say, oh no, I don't believe in God. I'm an atheist, one of the least trusted groups in America. Or you could just kind of say like, yeah, sure, I believe in God, leave me alone. And phone calls over, it's fine. So we tried to come up with an indirect way to measure the prevalence of atheism that doesn't require people to actually kind of out themselves to a stranger, and stumbled across this measurement tool from sort of sociology and criminology, where it turns out for a lot of things where you want to establish kind of a population level baseline of how common things are that people don't want to admit to, it's tricky. So this tool is called the unmatched count technique or the list measure technique. And it's been used trying to get kind of population baselines for a lot of socially undesirable things. Shows up in surveys about like drug use, problem drinking. I've seen it used to try to get baseline estimates of the prevalence of date rape on university campuses. Things where you can't just go out and ask the perpetrators like, hey, have you done this bad stuff?
Right.
Yeah. Right. And so how it works is you get a big group of people in your sample and you randomly split them into a couple groups. And you say to all of them, all right, we'll be doing this task. And for this task, I'm going to list some statements. And you're just going to tell me how many of these statements are true for you. So one group, they just get kind of boring statements. So, you know, my favorite color is red. I like hot dogs. I brush my teeth every day. I own a dog. I can ride a motorcycle. And then you ask people, well, how many of those are true for you? Nobody has to tell you which of the items are true. They're just giving you a number. So some people say two, some people say four. So far, so good. And then that's kind of your baseline condition. And then in your other experimental condition, you give people the exact same list of kind of boring mundane items, plus the socially sensitive item that you care about. So this group of people, they might get, you know, let's see if I can reproduce my list. My favorite color is red. I like hot dogs. I brush my teeth every day. I can ride a motorcycle. I drink and drive. So that's your socially sensitive item, right? The first group didn't get the drinking and driving item. The second group did. So since they got the exact same list, except for one item, we can infer that the difference in average scores between the two groups is attributable to how many people would have answered yes for that socially loaded item. So imagine, you know, if the first group on average, if their average score was, you know, 3.2, and the second group, their average score was 3.4, that's different by 0.2. So I'd say, all right, I'm guessing that 20% of the overall population would have answered in the affirmative to that socially loaded item.
Because you have enough people where those other things are stable. We know what they are for large groups. So it just measures that one item.
Yeah, so you kind of build in some of these assumptions that, you know, thanks to random assignment, there's no other particular reason to think the numbers would differ between these two groups. But yeah, as you also mentioned, you need a giant sample of people to use this tool. And even then, your estimates end up being not particularly precise, which is one of the limitations. But when we did this, Maxine and I did this in two different nationally representative samples in the U.S. with a couple thousand participants per sample. And our best guess based on this was that it's actually closer to like 25% of people in the U.S. don't believe in God, which is starkly different from what, you know, Gallup and Pew polls were saying at the time. They were saying, even if you just look at what percentage of people say no when you ask them if they believe in God, they were looking at 10 to 12%. So we're looking at almost double that with this indirect measurement tool.
Yeah. But now, I mean, so that's 5 years ago. So now I think Pew's most recent finding is about 25%, maybe just under, as groups of nuns. Has their methodology finally caught up? Is there less shame as to being an atheist? By the way, in atheism being as shameful as date rape and smoking crack.
Right.
Oh my God. Will, is it that harsh?
It's not necessarily the case that it's as shameful as that, but a tool that you would use to figure out who's smoking crack is also a good tool to figure out, you know, who are the closeted atheists.
All right. Yeah. Okay. That sounds a little better. So anyway, back to Pew. Did their methodology catch up? Has there been a change in that level of shame, or has the number just like doubled? Where do we know, or where do you think we are now?
Yeah, it's interesting looking at, I mean, the great thing with Gallup and Pew is they have great rigorous sampling and they keep running polls with some of the same questions year after year. So you can actually track changes over time. And you can also look to see, you know, if you see changes in this Believe in God one, is it that we're getting, you know, cohort level differences where, you know, we have more young people in the sample and young people are less religious. It could be that. But what I've noticed, even since we did these studies kind of in, you know, the 20 teens, even their self-report data, we're seeing more and more people saying they don't believe in God. So like I mentioned, yeah, they're 2016, 2017. I'd have to look up the exact values, but I think they went from 11% to kind of 14% to 15, 16, 17% of people saying they don't believe in God. So it does look like we're getting more and more people, even on the straightforward self-reports, who are now saying they don't believe in God. We haven't tried in a nationally representative set to use our sneaky indirect method. So I'm not sure if that's been going up as well. So the self-reported atheism rates getting higher, and without kind of some additional checks with our method, we don't know whether it's the case that both self-report and indirectly measured atheism is getting more prevalent, or it could just be that self-reports are starting to track closer to our indirect estimate, which, as you mentioned, it could just be that atheism is getting kind of gradually destigmatized. Then we'd expect the sneaky method and the blunt force method to converge over time.
Yeah. And I think the other thing you brought up, the cohort, I think there's definitely been big changes generationally. So even in the 5 years, as more people came into the 18 to 25 group, they've shown higher rates of irreligion.
Yeah, it looks in the U.S. and then elsewhere. I know I was just chatting with a colleague where we were combing through some kind of archival data sets, and the cohort level differences are substantial. Kind of each new generation popping into the surveys is looking less religious than the previous ones in a lot of US, Canada, Western European samples.
Mm. So is there a definite cause here, like why that's happening? Or is it like, should we just assume that it's as the world becomes more irreligious, more people become irreligious? Is it sort of a feedback loop that's generating this?
Yeah, sort of the theoretical story we've been tinkering with lately is that it's almost like you have kind of a two or three stage process going on. So a lot of work in sociology of religion over the years, they've put forward kind of what they called secularization theory, which is just the idea that as kind of social conditions get better in places, people are just less motivated by religion. So you could see this in kind of post-war Europe. You saw a lot of places, you know, economies took off, they built social safety nets, you saw good public education, public health, things like that. And as people's just day-to-day lives start to feel a lot more secure, that rise in existential security seems to lead people to just kind of find religion a bit less compelling. So that's the first stage, is you kind of have rising social and economic conditions will lead people to, you know, it's not necessarily that people flip a switch and they're atheist overnight, but instead it's like you'll see more people who might still believe in God, but they're not going to church as much. They're less likely to, you know, tithe regularly. And now if we turn back to what we were chatting about earlier with the kind of credibility enhancing displays of religion. What happens is, you know, economic and social conditions get more favorable, people are less motivated by religion, then you imagine the next cohort of people growing up, and they're looking to these people as kind of models in a cultural learning sense, they're just seeing fewer credibility enhancing displays of religious faith. So it's that second generation that grows up largely non-religious, just because they didn't grow up seeing as many visible cues of religiosity. So that general pattern holds pretty well, where you see, you know, social economic conditions get favorable, you see church attendance decline, and then it's the next generation grows up with much lower levels of religious belief. So that's kind of our working theory. There's some kind of oddball countries that don't fit the trend well, but, you know, science is messy.
Right. Yeah.
We're working on it.
Yeah. What do you think is sort of the long-term future here? I mean, is it going to be that religion just declines indefinitely for the, like, and then, or is there going to be some sort of point where like the level of religion kind of plateaus?
Yeah, it's tricky to project. And if you you can go back and people have been predicting the imminent demise of religion for, you know, the entire last century, and they've been wrong every single time. So I think that religions, they're good fits for human minds. Like we have a very easy time thinking about disembodied supernatural agents. At the same time, culturally successful religions, they've done a great job at kind of meeting people's needs. So yeah, we have minds that evolved in ways such that religion's a good fit. And then through kind of cultural evolutionary competition, successful religions have good bundles of norms and beliefs that, you know, they bring communities together. So they've been too successful for too long. I don't think religion's fading away anytime soon. But, you know, that little model I was just sketching out, we are seeing in a lot of places kind of religious fervor declining and then people growing up without credible cues. So I think right now we're in a period where that's an interesting balancing act. Religion's not totally crashing out most places. But if you look in kind of a lot of places in Western Europe, you do see that, you know, pretty drastic declines in religious attendance and even belief. So where will this all head kind of globally 100 or more years out? Who knows? You know, religions are going to culturally adapt. We'll see more efforts to kind of attract and retain adherents. Also, you have some demographic issues where it turns out atheists tend not to have a lot of kids.
Right. Yeah.
You play that out for a while and just the numbers game is not on the side of the secularists. So I think we're in a period of weird kind of balance. There's also some work suggesting that, you know, it's in times of peace and stability and prosperity that religion fades. Well, if you've been paying attention to the world lately, that's not exactly how things feel at the moment. So kind of underlying social conditions are actually potentially favorable towards religion. Things feel a bit chaotic, and to a lot of people, religion is what you turn to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess another thing is that the sort of the concept of religion itself is a little bit fuzzy. And so I guess if you sort of think about kind of like an evolutionary impulse to religion. I mean, it's not clear like what that means. I mean, I guess I can ask as a question sort of like, is it the ritual aspect or the kind of community or is there a need to believe in sort of supernatural agents? And I guess the question could be, could these kind of impulses be kind of redeployed or satisfied in a different way in a secular society?
Yeah, certainly. So as you mentioned, there does seem to be sort of a religious impulse, and I would potentially reframe that. So I don't think we as a species evolved specifically to have religion. Some people have, you know, tried to push the notion, oh, maybe there's like a God part of the brain. It doesn't look like that's the case. I think kind of the prevailing cognitive model of religion these days is that religion works well as sort of an evolutionary byproduct. So we've evolved to live in social groups, for example. This means we need some cognitive machinery that's good at thinking about other people's mental states. So I've got to be able to see, to imagine what's going on in somebody else's head so I can predict their behavior. Now, if I'm good at imagining other people's minds in general, maybe it's not so hard for me to imagine something that's just mine. So instead of thinking about my buddy has a mind, I can think of maybe there's stuff that's just kind of incorporeal minds. So this could be thinking about ancestor spirits or life after death, or even kind of these big omnipresent deities. So it could be that religious concepts end up just kind of piggybacking on our ordinary cognitive machinery that evolved for social interactions. So that's kind of one plausible story of kind of what's the original, you know, psychological nugget of religion. Other people have written about how kind of another role that religion serves psychologically is, our species, we're really curious. We like trying to explain things, and we like trying to figure out what stuff means. So this kind of predilection to find meaning and patterns, turns out religions are great fits for that. So religions can kind of fit this need for meaning. So that's one area where I think this kind of general impulse to find meaning, I think that's one where if we call that a religious impulse, that can just be co-opted in secular ways fairly easily. People might say, well, instead of turning to religion to make for, you know, sense of order and meaning, maybe you turn to science and hope that science can do the same thing for you there.
Mm, that's a great point. What do you, Nathan, before we move on to can a true atheist, should we have Will try to wrap things up, give us one main takeaway, and then move on to can a true atheist?
Sure, sounds good.
The lightning round. So Will, if speaking very broadly, do you have, what would be the most important takeaway of your research that you would want to impart on people?
The most important thing from our research? I guess I could give a couple. So first, we've got a lot of research now looking at people's negative perceptions of atheists. And what I think is at the heart of a lot of people not liking atheists is just kind of some intuitive misconceptions about how morality works. So a lot of people think that you need religion to be moral. And if that's kind of your gut level model of how morality works, then obviously atheists are moral wildcards and you can't trust them. But it turns out that our work on morality shows us that that's not how morality works. So I think a lot of people, if they have this intuitive kind of distrust of atheists, it's because they're misunderstanding where morality comes from. Whatever the link between religion and morality is, it's not one-to-one. So there's no particular reason to distrust atheists. The second, I guess, take-home message in terms of instead of looking at kind of perceptions of atheists, I think the take-home on kind of what are the sources of atheism is that this kind of common narrative about, oh, atheists are just fancy pants, clever people who learn some science and that's how they're atheists, I think that's largely a myth. It's a myth that at times is promoted by especially the most vocal atheists out there. So you have, you know, Dawkins says, oh, he was a church-going boy and then he read some Darwin and bam, atheism. And whether or not that's how the trajectory actually went for him, that's not the trajectory that our science is telling us is where atheists come from. And especially, yeah, that new atheist set, kind of core to their whole project was the idea that they could use science as a wedge to pry people away from religion. But it turns out they misdiagnosed the science on where atheism comes from. You're not going to turn people into atheists by, you know, trying to make them think rationally. That's just not how it works. And they got the science wrong. And as a result, you know, their whole project is kind of predicated on a bunch of bad assumptions. And they would have known better if they actually engaged with the science on how religion works in the first place. So atheism, it's not all about rationality and science-mindedness. A lot of it just comes down to kind of cultural cues.
Yeah, that's a great point. And thankfully, now that they've heard you say it, they won't make that same mistake again.
Right.
Yeah, problem solved, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. So, okay. So shall we move on to the lightning round?
Lightning round. Let's do it.
Right. Okay. All right. Well, so we have a lightning round called Can a True Atheist? And it's about what a true atheist can do. So for example, can they say, oh my God, or would then, if they were to do that thing, would then they get their atheist card kind of taken away?
Oh, okay. Yeah. Yes. I gotcha.
So
can a true atheist be a true Scotsman?
Yeah. Right,
exactly. Exactly what it is. Yeah. So, and you can offer an explanation. It's yes, no, but we enjoy a good explanation.
Short explanation, I guess. Yeah. So we're going to ask some questions and let us know what you think. So the first one, this is an easy one perhaps. Can a true atheist believe in God?
I would say no, kind of definitionally so.
Right, okay.
Right, that's a good answer. We'll take that. Can a true atheist date someone who is religious?
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, they might have interesting conversations, but as far as I can think of, there's no particular reason they couldn't.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Can a true atheist deny that they're an atheist?
Oh, absolutely. The majority of people in our large scale surveys who don't believe in God do not identify as atheists.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Mm. All right. Can a true atheist work as a priest or other religious leader?
I suspect a great many have, yes.
That would be, now that survey, if you did your survey with just faith instructor, just men of the cloth. That would be super interesting.
We've thought of trying to deploy it, to get, you know, priests, pastors. My former job, I was at the University of Kentucky, so right in the heart of the Bible Belt, we thought of trying to roll that survey out at some of these like giant sprawling suburban mega churches. Had a hard time getting buy-in from the churches to let us come in and do that.
Right. Yes. Oh, yeah. I can see why that might be. Yes. Yeah. All right. Can a true atheist name their child Faith, for example?
Yeah, sure. If we wanted to stick with, faith wouldn't even necessarily have to mean it in a religious sense. But even if they wanted to name their kid faith in the religious sense, why not?
Right. Can a true atheist believe in good and bad luck?
Sure. I think some people would try to interpret atheism incredibly narrowly, as in, you know, this must be a perfectly rational person who holds no spooky or mysterious beliefs. But I think in their case, they're kind of operating from a false premise. Like, people were not all that rational as a species. So you're just not going to find that many people who are that purely rational.
Can a true atheist follow religious dietary restrictions like kosher or something like that?
Sure. Why not? I mean, I'm seeing fewer reasons for them to initially start it. But it's funny, my wife and I earlier today, we were talking about, like, I've always felt like one of these years I'm going to attempt Ramadan just to see what it feels like out of my own curiosity. And I always talk this way right as Ramadan is ending. I'm conspicuously silent about doing Ramadan before it. Yes. But I think it would be fascinating to try. Absolutely.
Yeah, that is true. Yeah, I mean, you fast for how long is it? It's several weeks, right?
Sunrise to sundown for, I think a month.
Right.
Yeah, for a matter of time. And we were just talking because the big feast at the end would have to be the best feast ever.
Yeah.
It would be phenomenal.
Yeah, that's what I've heard. Yeah. Yeah. No, that's an interesting idea though. Yeah.
Yeah. And finally, can a true atheist hold prejudiced views about atheists?
Yes. Yes, they can. And we've even done some work on this subject where people across 13 countries, including atheists in secular countries, seem to intuitively think that serial killers don't believe in God.
Wow.
Right. Right. Yeah.
What? Wow. Yeah. That's crazy.
Yes. Well, that's, yeah.
Yeah. I never would have even considered that. And that's just that's intuitive thinking again, huh? See where it gets you?
Yeah, exactly. At the gut level, even the atheists seem a little bit morally suspicious of atheists.
Great. You know, it's the date rape and crack smoking thing. All right. Will, this has been incredibly illuminating. Thank you so much for joining us. Can you stick around for some behind-the-scenes stuff, a bonus segment for some of our patrons?
Absolutely, I'd love to, and thanks for having me.
Okay, that was Dr. Will Gervais. Todd, what did you take away from that conversation?
There's so much to take away. One of the thing I love about conversations like that is every time he finds an answer, right, it just leads to more questions. I want to know more about everything. Like, it's both illuminating and... like, and it leads to the next step, which is what we're about at Beyond Atheism. Right? Mm-hmm. Like, I mean, just if you, from our starting point, right? Like, this is something we've started thinking about. We've just begun talking about this. Like, what is it that made you an atheist? And it turns out, you know, we might be wrong. Just like our version of ourself, right?
Yeah, I think that's
the thing that we tell ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because I definitely make sense from a personal perspective to say, like, it's because I'm so smart and I saw through all of this stuff.
But, right.
And I mean...
we love that narrative for ourselves. Yeah.
Yeah, but it could be various factors in your life about how, like, your own relationship to religion and, like, other people's, the way they have practiced their religion and how that influenced you. I mean, it's like... And it's also hard to even know, you know, like I sort of think for myself, I sort of interestingly came to atheism a bit later than most people, I think, like in my early 20s. And it was sort of through like, you know, watching like new atheist debates and so on. And I think that eventually kind of pushed me into atheism. So I don't know what my point is there, but I guess it's, you know, these sort of random factors that kind of appear in your life. Like if I hadn't decided to go down that route of watching those videos and stuff, maybe I wouldn't have become an atheist, or I wouldn't have, you know, maybe I would have stayed like kind of a liberal Christian or something like that.
Yeah. Or why did you even do that, Nathan?
Why did I decide to watch the videos?
Why did you even decide to watch those videos?
Yeah, that's a good point. I think it was like, well, part of me was almost scared to do it because I was like,
taboo, forbidden, you know, fruit.
Well, it was more like, it was more that having religion was sort of comforting and so on. And like, and I definitely had some doubts, but I was kind of feeling like, I don't know, you know, how deep to kind of go down this rabbit hole. But then I figured like, you know, I should do it. And I'm like, probably the Christians are going to be debating. They'll probably have really great arguments.
Right. To shore you back up. Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. Yeah. So, yeah. But what was it for you? I mean, do you think there was something about the religiosity you saw from other people that was sort of hypocritical or in some way?
You know what? I don't even know. I remember like always thinking it was bullshit, you know, like it just didn't make sense to me. You try prayer and it doesn't work. How much more do you need? Right. Like it's just not doing that thing. And no, like it doesn't, you know, maybe there is that thing that it's everything around us. And he talked about both the aspects of secularization theory, which I think like if it's this like industrialization that does it, if you build up this social safety net and then the need goes away, and then you have a modern society where things are pretty predictable and stable, it becomes less appealing, right? So, I mean, that definitely explains what the world was like at the time I became an atheist, the world that I grew up into and was raised in. So that's definitely part of it. And yeah, I'm sure that there are these aspects of people not living the way they claim, or religion not suiting them the way it's said, right? Like it's a lot of bullshit. My hometown had church pedophile scandals as well, but I was already, you know, I'd hated priests for years by that point. So I'm sure that contributes to it, to a lot of people. And just the idea of like,
displays?
Credible displays, right? Which, if you flip that around, I think what that did for me, him talking about that, it helps explain why putting up crosses everywhere is so important. And
yeah,
putting right. In God We Trust on the money is so important. And putting the Ten Commandments in front of government buildings and in schools is so important. And praying at schools is so important because you need that, because your faith is fragile, right? Like if you don't have these constant symbols that reinforce it, something that's there that constantly reinforces it, it's going to go away.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's a good point. It's just something sort of like, it's just like the oxygen or something, like it's just around, like it's everywhere. And when it's everywhere, you don't really think that there's an alternative.
Yeah, totally.
So I think that's a really good point, that it's just, if you can just sort of get it to be, this is just the way it is, rather than being like, you know, some people are not religious, some people are. And then obviously that encourages you to think like, well, why aren't some people religious?
Right, think about it. Your faith should not be challenged by a 20-minute YouTube video. That's astounding. And talking about it this way, right, like this, that you need this constant reinforcement, you need something that we can all collectively focus on. So it's not just that I see it and reinforces my faith. It's not just that you see it and it reinforces your faith. It's that I know you see it as well, right? That we both share this, and we share the connection to each other. We both know that we're surrounded by these symbols. And I mean, this is the way North Korea works, right?
Right.
Everybody wears the little yeah. Kim pins. When one of them dies, you have this collective mourning. And if you talk to people who, or if you read accounts of people who've been through that, the thing they say is like, I wasn't really sad. I was kind of happy, but everybody around me was crying. Right. So like, yeah, I don't believe in Jesus. I'm not really in this whole God thing. I'm not sure about it. But, you know, in my community, in my hometown, you know, the bakery has a cross, and you go down the street across from the post office. We've got this cross, and, you know, we've got this little temple of remembrance right outside the school, whatever it is. Right. Of course, of course, that has an effect. But once you get to a point where your society doesn't rely on that, once you start removing those, once you think, you know, it's not important to say Merry Christmas to everybody you see, I don't need to do that. I guess it can challenge and erode faith.
Yeah, I think so. I think another interesting point was he was talking about kind of the individual differences. I mean, like, even though they were slight, he did say that atheists were slightly more like analytical thinkers versus like more instinctual, even though like you said, like it's a really small difference. And I definitely can see how that, I mean, like, I don't know. I mean, like for myself, like I would say I'm probably an analytical thinker, I think, but then I can also see how in a particular context that analytical thinking could just be turned to like coming up with reasons why God exists or whatever. So I think it's like, you know, there is this combination of like, yes, maybe there's some like minor kind of individual things, but then it has to take place in a particular context, which is favorable to you kind of developing this atheist worldview.
Yeah. And I mean, I'm sure like intuitive religious thinking has to be indoctrinated at some point, right?
Yeah. Yes. Right. Yeah. I mean, yeah. Like if you were alone on a desert island or something, would you reason this, or what would you come up with on your own? I don't know. Probably not. It wouldn't look like Christianity probably, or any of the other religions, I guess. I don't know.
Yeah. But also things like if you go back to medieval medicine and see people talking about how someone's jaundiced, right? They have a very yellow color. Well, feed him lots of yellow things. That'll right. help with the jaundice, because like goes with like. You see, that's just common sense. You just know it. You see yellow. You see someone who looks yellow. You feed them something yellow. That has to be taught, that sort of thinking. Whereas, you know, analytic thinking is also taught.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Yes.
Right. You go through, you know, liberal education, meaning like, you know, universal liberal in your sense, right? Like we're individuals, we have rights by nature. We ought to behave in this way. That sort of liberal. If you go through that, yeah, you're taught a certain sense of how to analyze things, right?
Yeah, right. So, I mean, it's not even necessarily like, it's sort of about like innate personality differences. That also is kind of contingent on like the education you receive and so on.
Yeah. So like if we're talking about a political issue, right, we would probably frame it in terms of harm if you're trained in a certain way, right? Whereas people who aren't trained, you have these very intuitive ones that go into either like disgust or moral outrage or loyalty, right? Things like that.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That's the way you would frame it.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, we got so far off track here, Nathan. But like, this is what Will Gervais' work does, right? It gets your brain going and starts thinking about, okay, what do we know? How does this fit into other things we know? And where does it move to next? And this is, I think, a brilliant insight. I'd love to know more about how other people, like, how does this change the way you see yourself as an atheist, right? You're an analytic person. You think a certain way. You think for yourself. You've always challenged ideas. You've challenged norm. You're transgressive. You're trying to move beyond good and evil. Or, no, like, society did it. Society made me what I am. So hit us up with that. Leave comments. You can, of course, any complaints, insights, send them our way at Twitter, Nath G. Alexander.
Yes.
On the Elon Musk box there.
Yeah, right. Yeah. Yep. Yeah, and we got to make sure to thank our patrons, Lars, Debbie, and the AHS Plus blog. Thank you guys so much for your support. And people should, if you're enjoying the show, definitely support us on Patreon and get access to bonus content.
Absolutely. Will gets controversial in the later
one. Yes, right.
And, you know, we love all the listeners anyway. If you can't contribute money, we understand. Like, subscribe, that's free. Just so ring the bell, kick the button. Is there anything else you can do to it? Ring the bell. You ring bells.
Ring, yes. Yeah, I guess ring the bell. That's ring on one bell. Of the platforms, I think.
Yeah.
Yes.
Press the button. Click the thing. Click the click. All right. Well, excellent. Until next time.